And now, after a long night of counting, it's clear that we're winning enough states to reach 270 electoral votes needed to win the presidency.
This is a major fraud in our nation. So we'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ed Gotham, and welcome to Opto Sessions, where we interview the top traders and investors from around the world, uncovering their secrets to success. This is a US election special where I have the pleasure of talking to JC Peretz, the founder of All Star Charts, about price action and opportunities he's seeing in the market today. As JC says, it's not about being right, it's about making money. And we highlight the sectors and themes hitting all-time highs in global stocks, as well as touching on interesting action in gold and Bitcoin. Enjoy.
Price, that's the number one technical indicator.
You do best by investing for the longer term.
If you can't explain what the business is doing, then that is a huge red flag.
Some technological change is going to put you out of business.
It really is a genuinely extraordinary situation.
Welcome back, JC. How's everything going there?
Everything's going great. No complaints. You know, a lot of charting, good music, good wine.
And obviously, yeah, it's been a bit of a very interesting week this week so far. But we're here to discuss the price action. And this is a sort of US election special. The chatter in the markets appears to be that there's, you know, the market's moving in terms of a Biden victory. Do you agree with that? And what does that mean, if anything, for the markets?
Yeah, I can't speak to that. I don't know anything about electoral colleges or, you know, I don't know anything about that stuff. I get like different states have, you know, different amount of votes and stuff like that. Like, I get that. I go to the polling booth. I do my duty and vote. But after that, it's out of my hands. I can only follow what the market's doing. I can't tell you what it means. What it means to me is that they're buying stocks. Stocks are breaking out. Materials are making new highs. Healthcare is breaking out to new highs. You know, and not just healthcare as a group, but biotechnology, medical equipment, the healthcare providers like UNH, monster moves. You know, we're getting that rotation back into apparently communications and technology, and sort of that trade that has been working so well, that money rotated out of starting in early September and moved into areas like utilities, areas like industrials and emerging markets. Now it's sort of, you know, this week it's all been working, you know, all of them are doing well. So it's just really interesting, you know, even a day like today, we're recording this on a Thursday, the 5th, but on Wednesday, the 4th, the day after the election, small caps underperformed, you know, the large cap tech and communications like pretty dramatically. And then here we are the following day and they're keeping up, even outperforming. So, you know, that's the big thing for me. It really is the interest rates story, because after the election, interest rates got absolutely slammed. So while all the focus and attention is on the stock market doing so well, which is fantastic, we're happy about it. We were betting that that's what was going to happen, right? So, you know, no complaints here, but my bigger question, like, stocks are doing well. Good. We expected them to do well. So no surprises there. For me, it was really interest rates getting slammed after the election. That was surprising, not so much surprising, but I mean, it was a big move. So definitely something worth, watching. And then the day after, things are coming back, but that's my bigger question, I think.
And if that trend in interest rates was to go down further, what does that mean for stocks, et cetera?
Well, part of our thesis and, you know, coming into this rally that we're seeing this week, well, you know, the election week, the bet was that commodities and stocks were pointing towards higher interest rates, right? Because we're seeing outperformance from regional banks, which is consistent with higher rates. We're seeing copper outperforming gold, once again, consistent with higher rates. And then interest rates were going out at 4-month highs on the U.S. 10-year yield. And after the election, they got slammed. So they're back today, but if interest rates break down and start making new lows, like the rest of the developed markets, because the U.S. interest rates have been going up, but global developed market rates just have not participated. It's like, which one is right? So if interest rates are not breaking out in the U.S., then that regional bank outperformance, that copper outperforming gold, you know, those trends aren't in place either, in my opinion. So that would be more bullish for gold, precious metals relative to base metals. That would be less bullish for U.S. equities. So I'm thinking interest rates go up, regional banks continue this outperformance. That's sort of how I see that reflation trade. You know, you're seeing emerging markets outperforming. Look at China. Chinese internet, Chinese technology, all breaking out of monster bases. So for me, all of that points to higher rates, and rates rolling over and collapsing would put a major wrench in that thesis.
Okay. And yeah, like you said, a lot of the charts across a lot of different areas, just it feels like a lot of them look like things are just getting started potentially. I mean, they look like they're setting up very bullishly. In terms of major indices, what sort of levels are you watching at the moment, sort of NASDAQ?
You know, 281 on the Qs, that's the big level. Got to be above 281 on the Qs and 3250 on the S&Ps. Those are the levels that I'm watching on the indexes. But for me, I'm less about specific levels in the indexes. I'd say earlier in my career when I was younger, I'd focus a lot more on individual levels in the indexes. And over the years, talking with as many smart people as I get to speak to on a regular basis, not to mention my experience day to day and week to week and month to month and year over year, going through individual stocks and sectors and sort of identifying whether the majority are going up or the majority are breaking out, or are they completing tops and breaking down? Like what are the components of these indexes doing? And that has been much more valuable than specific levels. Now, at the end of the day, we're still identifying key support and resistance levels. And I'm not even looking at the chart. I just know my head, QQQ 281, S&P 500, 3250. I know that. I mean, I could draw the damn charts for you going back decades. for me, it's more of a function of what are the stocks themselves doing? What kind of rotation are we seeing? Which sectors are outperforming? Is it staples? Because when that's happening, it's probably not a function of a bullish stock market, but the opposite. And that's not what's happening. Staples are underperforming. We're getting positive rotation into industrials. Materials are making new highs. Emerging markets are making new highs. I think small caps and mid caps come next. Transports haven't done anything in almost 3 years and are just now breaking out of a base. So when people are like, oh, stocks only go up, I'm like, what stocks are you looking at, bro? Like the market doesn't revolve around the NASDAQ 100. Like look at the Hang Seng in Hong Kong. That thing hasn't done anything in 12 years. You know, look at the U.S. financials index, still under those 07 highs, hasn't done anything for 13 years. So when you're looking at it, and this is Hang Seng. This is U.S. financials. I mean, these are the most important markets on earth, you know, some of them. And they haven't done anything in over a decade. So for me, this whole notion that stocks only go up and this is a bubble and this and that, you know, I continue to argue that we're probably closer to the beginning of a new bull market than we are near the end of an old one.
And so would you say you're looking a lot at the themes, the thematic sort of investing approach. Is that what you're saying, that you like that sort of approach to the markets and investing, or?
Well, it's a weight of the evidence, right? It's not one index. It's not one indicator. It's not one magic scan. It doesn't work that way. It's taking the data as it comes in, continuing to, you know, build that puzzle and see, and you know, just like I'm identifying right now, be like, this is what we think is going to happen.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to point out what the market would have to do to invalidate your thesis. So the way I see the fourth quarter progressing and into the first quarter is interest rates higher, financials participating, emerging markets continuing to outperform, transports and industrials and materials continue to make new highs. You know, China continues to lead that emerging market story, and there will be other countries that will participate, like Taiwan, has been a leader in the emerging market space, you know, Taiwan Semi and, yep, you know, semiconductors and chips. And that's more of a function of the sector specific that semiconductors are doing well. I mean, this is one of the best places in the world. So Taiwan obviously is going to participate in that. So you're seeing Taiwan, seeing China, you know, really lead the leadership group of emerging markets is more tech oriented, as opposed to when I first came into the business and I started working at Merrill Lynch in 2003, the first 4 years of my life, emerging markets were the outperformers, and this was a natural resource led group, and emerging markets were up on average 100% a year for the first 4 years of my career, which is crazy to think about. But emerging markets look much different today than they once did. So yeah, I think it's important to realize, to recognize that.
And so in terms of like tech, US tech then, because we're having a strong week this week, but you think that into Q4, that's, you're going to see these other things like industrials outshine them?
They might. You know, I could see industrials outperforming tech. I could see that. I could see emerging markets and some of that more reflation trade outperforming tech. It doesn't mean tech's going to go down. It doesn't mean communications aren't going to go down, but they can perform with the market or slightly underperform.
Yeah.
I don't think that would be a bad thing. It would probably be a good thing. That would point to that strength in other areas.
Yeah, yeah.
So a tech underperforming here, I think would be perfectly acceptable, normal, and I would argue healthy.
Yeah. In terms of emerging markets, what are you looking at to sort of get exposure to those? What sort are you looking at? What sort of ETFs or?
You know, I don't think you need to get cute. You know, for me, EEM gets it done. You're getting a lot of China. If you want to be more China specific, you can be CQQQ is the tech of China. You know, you can own KWEB, which gives you more Alibaba because that's Chinese internet. So KWEB, so there's different ETFs. And then what I like to do is that I like to see where the strength is, because our analysis starts at the country. So, okay, first of all, group of countries, so emerging markets, individual countries. Okay, fine. China. Within China, what? China tech, so, or China internet. So then we'll look at the components of these indexes and look for individual names like Tencent, for example, which looks great, or Alibaba, or some of these other names, and they're individual stocks. So how do you find these stocks using this top-down approach?
Yeah.
Is that when you identify the space that you like, you go look at the components in that space and see if there are individual stocks that can give you exposure. But like for me, we have a lot of clients that are financial advisors. They would rather be in the ETF than in the stock. In many cases, they can't be in the stock because they just manage an ETF portfolio. In the case of an individual investor who wants a higher beta and wants a more, you know, more movement and more volatility, then the stock would be better than an ETF. So one or two stocks within the ETF, or three, depending on how diversified you want to be, you know, within that. And then if you really want the juice and you really want to get it going, then you could put an options trade on an ADR. You know, you can do that as well. So there's a lot of different ways to take advantage of that, depending on who you are and what your goals are. And it's different for everyone.
Yeah. And in terms of emerging markets, which ones, we've mentioned China, any other ones standing out to you?
Taiwan.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's more of the tech emerging markets, yeah, India. You know, India as well. And India has a lot of media and a lot of exposure to financials. So like if you can do like an India X financials.
Yeah. Okay. And I would just want to talk about energy. And also some of the people the market hasn't been looking at for a while.
Yeah.
I think some people have said the most hated sector in the market at the moment, especially for like investment managing stuff. Will it have its day again? Yeah. Is there something going to come back there or?
You know, we just covered our shorts in ExxonMobil. You know, it was a great short when it started breaking down under 40. And our target was the former lows from March, the March lows.
Yeah.
And we got there. So mission accomplished, right? So now the question is, all right, so we covered our shorts. Do we want to get long now? And these are two different conversations. You know, so there's two arguments. The argument is you can have such a mean reversion rally here that it's worth the risk. Because what's the risk? It's minimal, because the trade is you're only long Exxon if you're above the March lows, right? That's the trade.
Yeah.
The other argument is if the stock market's making all-time highs, why are you buying this garbage? know?
Yeah, it's opportunity cost.
Stock market's making all-time highs, then maybe we should be buying the stocks that are also making all-time highs. If the stock market is like bottoming out and we think it's making lows like we did in March, we're going to be buying stocks that are not making new highs because there are no stocks making new highs. We're looking at maybe showing relative strength in that environment, you know, like what we were looking at in March. Like in March, we saw relative strength in Zoom, DocuSign, Peloton. The relative strength was already there. And then, you know, there's wisdom there. And then we saw what happened after that. In the case of, you know, energy, it could work. It could totally work.
Risky.
Of course it's, I mean, you're buying garbage. You're buying the worst things in the world. Like there's nothing worse than energy, you know? I mean, energy is worse than financials. And that's saying a lot, you know? So can they go up? You know what? They probably do. They probably do. I'm not in them. I've been looking at them because I can't help myself. And me and my friends, this is the stuff we talk about. Like I put a starter position on, like stuff like that. I have one guy who shoots cannons. That's what he says. He's like, I shot one of the cannons. That means he puts like one tranche of purchase.
Yeah.
Ready for my next cannon. And then he shoots another cannon is what he calls it. So I haven't shot any cannons.
And we've mentioned the banks, regional banks. Obviously another sector that hasn't been doing well. You mentioned that in Q4, you're actually thinking they're going to make a comeback. Is that the trend you're sort of looking at them?
Well, while tech, you know, quietly, while tech has been, you know, getting slammed, not slammed, but, you know, rotation out of tech and communications and consumer discretionaries, particularly Amazon, since the beginning of September, regional banks have outperformed in that environment, right? So quietly outperforming, in fact, making regional banks on a relative basis just made, what is it? We're in August, October, 5 month highs. In, you know, on a relative basis, regional banks.
Yeah.
And nobody's talking about it. And with that, interest rates were also making new 4 month highs, right? So that's not a coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Regional banks are outperforming in an environment that rates are going up. So that's part of that whole thing where, okay, stocks are going up. Great. We figured they would. That was the bet we were making.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if interest rates break down to make new lows, it puts a whole wrench on that regional bank rotation. It puts a whole wrench on all that thesis. So that's my bigger, not so much of a concern as, you know, that's what I'm watching. You know, now we're seeing, you know, gold miners really ripping. That's really interesting because this has been an area that's been under pressure as gold got back up to those 2011 highs and now are potentially breaking out. You know, because the question has been, how long is it going to take for gold to absorb that overhead supply from those 2011 highs, right? So the gold ripped, right, off the, you know, 99, 2000, 2001 lows, ripped, got up to the highs in 2011, completely collapsed from there, as we're all well aware, and now we're back to those highs. So if the market has proven anything, is that there's an overwhelming amount of sellers compared to buyers at this price. There's more supply than demand at this price. Why is that the case? I don't know. I'm sure that the sellers and buyers have a perfectly good reason why there are more sellers here. And what has the market proven in recent months? That there are still more sellers here. That hasn't changed. I have been confident that gold will ultimately resolve higher. My question was, how long is it going to take?
Yeah.
Because we could be sitting there waiting for a breakout. We could be sitting there till the second quarter. Meanwhile, Chinese internet is ripping and we're stuck in this hunk of metal that's not doing shit. Yeah. You know what I mean? So like, that's what I'm trying to avoid. It's not that I'm not bullish gold. I am. It's just, how long are you willing to be in this before it breaks out?
Yeah.
I'd rather buy the breakout like we did last year when it broke out. We bought the breakout, but we had been waiting for it. So it was, patience really paid off with gold last time. We waited to the breakout. We got it. It hit our target. We moved on and it hasn't done anything since then. Yeah. And it's just been a mess. So how long is it going to take? I don't know. This could be it. This could have been it. And now we rip and now we break out. It wouldn't surprise me at all, but I don't know. So I'd rather just wait. That's how I see it. But I would say that the move, post-election move, is interesting for sure.
And if it does break through those highs, clear sort of breakout, what does that mean? A lot higher? Is that what you think is going to tear higher after that?
Yeah. I mean, gold can go a lot higher. I mean, just think about what it did in the last cycle. You know, in the last cycle, gold was down in the 200s, right? And then it went up to 1900. Like, I don't know. I'm not like a math genius, but like that's quite a run. You know, that's what we're talking about. Four times, six, what is that? Seven times, seven bagger in gold. So let's say it does half that, right? Let's say last cycle was a seven bagger. Let's say it's a three bagger. You're looking at 6,000, right? Let's say it's a two bagger. Let's say it's not even close to last time, right? Not even close. 4,000. Make it three. Doesn't matter, right? It's whatever it is. The risk, like owning it above the former highs, right? The risk that you're taking by doing that and having that as your floor, relative to the potential upside. The potential upside is way more than the risk.
Yeah. And how do you manage getting yourself out of that trade at a good position if you want to run it? So how do you sort of manage a trade at that point?
Well, you want to set where you're wrong. And in my opinion, I think you're wrong if you're below the 2011 highs. If you're below that, then I think you're wrong. If you want to be a little bit more conservative, you can look at 1800. So like if you already want to be in it and you're willing to wait, 1800 is that level, the risk level. If we're not above 1800, you absolutely cannot be long gold, right? So that's like the worst case scenario for me. For me, I like things a little tighter. So, you know, that 1900, 1950, I would even argue 2000. I'd rather pay more knowing it's on the way up than sitting in a hunk of metal doing, you know, when I could be in Chinese internet or like literally in anything else, right? Because gold's done nothing since the summer when it hit our target. It's done nothing. So if you've been in this, you're not happy, right? You missed out on so much other stuff. So I look at opportunity cost as well.
Yep.
We hope you're enjoying the episode. For interviews like this every Thursday, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, make sure you give us a star rating and leave guest suggestions along with any other feedback in the review section. Now, back to the show.
Another place that's been interesting this year is online retail stocks. You've got Wayfair, Etsy, Amazon, Farfetch, etc. It seems like there's been a big shift. I mean, obviously coronavirus sort of like has forced a shift online. Probably will persist a little bit. Do you see those stocks have got a long, lot further to go?
Well, today is Thursday, and the online retail index ETF, IBUY, is literally making new all-time highs. and I think this is just another great example of relative strength, because this was breaking out. This was making all-time highs in May, right? So this is just a classic example of wisdom and relative strength. Was energy making new all-time highs in May? No. And look at it now, making all-time lows,
yeah.
Right? You know, so if you were buying energy because you were ignoring what was already working because you thought there was value there or whatever that, you know, what does value even mean, right? So if you were ignoring the relative strength because you thought that there was more value in energy and you didn't want to quote-unquote chase, you were severely wrong, yeah. Very wrong, and continue to be. So, which gets back to the earlier point, like this is making all-time highs and you want to be buying something that's making all-time lows. Like, you know, that just doesn't sit well with me. Like why would we do that?
Yeah.
That doesn't, you know, could we get a sick mean reversion and like an epic trade? Sure. Depends what you're into.
Yeah. And then you've also been talking today, or you retweeted something about biotech have been breaking out of long sort of bases formed over the last 5 years or something. The chart looks really good. It seems like it's repeated this sort of move before over time.
Definitely.
What are you thinking about those?
Well, you know, I'm looking at, there's two major indexes that, you know, that I follow. There's the IBB and there's the XBI. And the IBB is the index ETF by iShares. And it is a cap-weighted index, so you're going to have more exposure to Regeneron, Amgen, things like that. Meanwhile, XBI is the S&P Spider Biotech Index, and it's going to be on an equally weighted basis, so you're going to get a much more broad exposure to the biotechnology space. And in fact, the equally weighted XBI has been outperforming the cap-weighted IBB, which is really interesting. So they're breaking out to all-time highs. In the case of XBI, it had already been making all-time highs since May, speaking of relative strength, and the IBB, which is the cap-weighted index, did nothing since 2015. So remember, this is a sector that's been flat for half a decade. So zero progress. Granted, going into 2015 was absolute home runs. I mean, the biotech index was up like fivefold, off the 2009 lows and peaked in 2015 and has done nothing since then. Nothing. No progress. You know, I've been pulling out some of my old biotech workbooks and, some of these old charts like don't even exist anymore because like when you find a sector that's breaking out, then you want to do this deep dive and look at all the stocks in the sector, mid caps, and you find all these names. So I have like old workbooks that I haven't opened in forever because I haven't had to because these were not names that we've wanted to be in, but now it's different.
Yeah,
so it's funny. I'm like, oh my God, you know, that stock got bought out 6 years ago or 5 years ago and it's still in this workbook.
And how do you know if something is like overcooked or like gone too far? I don't know if that's ever, because stuff that I don't know if that's even a case, but obviously solar has been like TAM, massive trade. Again, this week, I think maybe something related to the Biden, win and support to clean energy and et cetera. I mean, it's been flying. And today, I mean, when I looked earlier, it was probably some of the biggest movers of the day.
Yeah, definitely. And getting back to energy, when you talk energy, do you want to buy old clunky Exxon and Chevron or do you want to be in the solar? Yeah. And I guess that's being answered for us. Clearly, investors are trying to be in the solar.
So how far do you know? I mean, I'm just trying to work out like when something has gone, because obviously biotech, we're going back to that 2015 high, it's gone up 5x. And if that's the case, solar's got a lot longer to go,
Yeah, look at, I mean, it depends on what we're talking about. Like, for example, Sunrun has had a huge move, but look at something like First Solar that's just now breaking out. First Solar hasn't done anything in, let's see. First Solar hasn't done anything in 6.5 years.
Yeah.
So, when you talk about stocks that have made a big run, some of them, no pun intended in the sun run, the First Solar simply has not. And it's one of the largest components in the solar index. I think it represents 7.5-8% of the index, FSLR, and it's flat over a 6.5 year period. And just now breaking out of this major base, that's not bearish.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's in Howard's 880 as well, I believe, First Solar. But it's an interesting one. Cryptos, Bitcoin. Oh, there's a lot of chatter about Bitcoin at the moment. Obviously, it's breaking out again. Is it? Do you see this as a major sort of positive bull market for crypto starting? Well, specifically Bitcoin, probably, but yeah.
I do. It's been hard to ignore because it was just, to me, it was quite obvious that 10,000 level was the breakout level. And if we were above 10,000, there was really no reason, really even 9,500, it was that range. If we're above that, there's really no reason not to own it. Because in a similar way to what we were talking about before in terms of the potential upside in gold, in the case of crypto, the beauty of the upside in gold is that the upside could potentially be a lot and the risk is very well defined. It's the exact same thing in Bitcoin. Obviously, a lot more volatile asset, obviously. But nevertheless, a very well-defined floor that you could trade against, and it's already up 50% since then. But what's the upside? Certainly back to the former highs, I think, is next. The question is, how does it act at those highs? So in the same way that our target in gold last year was the former highs, which we just achieved, right?
Yeah.
This summer.
The supply came in.
Bitcoin breaking out, our target is those former highs. Mm-hmm. It's fascinatingly similar. but it doesn't mean that I don't think Bitcoin can go above that.
Yeah, yeah.
I do. In the same way that just because our target in gold was the 2011 highs didn't mean that I didn't think it could go higher. So that was our target for the trade. And the market in gold has been acknowledging those former highs in a similar way to the fact that I think Bitcoin will acknowledge those highs and struggle at that level as well. The difference is, What's important to recognize is how it reacts to those former highs. Does it blow right past it and almost not acknowledge it? Because that would be really bullish. Like, for example, if gold got to these former highs in the summer and it's only been like 4 months or something like that, that we've been up here, and let's say we start breaking out right away, that would be very impressive. So that in and of itself is a bullish indicator how long it takes to break out. Same thing with Bitcoin. When we get up there, let's say we hang out there for a couple of weeks or a month or something, and then we take off, that would be so bullish. But for right now, that's the target.
Yeah.
How high from there after that? 20,000, 30,000, 50,000, 100, make it a million. The point is the risk reward is still skewed in favor of the bulls.
Yep. Yep. No, that's very clear. Yeah. I wanted to talk about some of the things you offer for your service. One of them is Under the Hood. If you could take people through like what it is, and it's like, obviously it's an interesting one. I've been following it, and I think other people would be interested in it too.
Yeah, you know, Under the Hood. So we do all this top-down work, as I mentioned before, you know, looking broadly around the world, you know, looking at the major indexes, working our way down to the sector. We discuss biotech, for example, and then within biotech, looking at the different components like Gilead or, mRNA. There's, you know, Jazz Pharmaceuticals. You know, there, you could look within the sectors, and that's the top-down work that we do. But in order to supplement all that top-down work, we have a series of universes of stocks that we call the bottoms up. So so we want to make it really, really hard to miss anything. We want to make it really difficult to miss anything. So the cool thing about Under the Hood is one of our universes, what we're looking for is a list of stocks showing an unusual increase in investor interest. And that could be super high volume, unusual options activity. Insider buying, mentions on social media. There's a variety of different ways that they come on our radar. And we essentially are looking under the hood. And we continue to get new data sources as well. So once we outline, let's say 40 or 50 stocks that are, again, are showing an unusual increase in investor interest for whatever the reason, usually about half those are probably on our radar anyway, you know? So you could probably knock all those off out of there, but it's the remaining ones that weren't on our radar, right? Or maybe hadn't been on our radar in a long time. But every list comes out, I'm like, XYZ, what is that? I don't know what that is. And then, you know, like when Workhorse, like now everybody knows Workhorse. But when Workhorse came on under the hood radar, I'm like, what is this Workhorse? It was like doubling and tripling. I'm like, wow, I don't know what this is, but this thing is awesome. now everybody's like, yeah, of course, Workhorse. Everybody knows Workhorse. But you know, we discovered that, you know, through this one scan. And then we have a few others. You know, we have the 2 to 100 list, which are stocks that are graduating from small cap to mid cap.
Yeah.
You know, getting above that $2 billion threshold and becoming mid caps that we think can be the next $100 billion companies, right? So hence the 2 to 100 club. And they have to fit within a series of industry groups that we think can scale at that level. So anyway, we create these universes, and then we overlay our technical analysis over it. So it's not like just this, we get this universe and buy them all blindly.
Yeah.
All we're doing is just bringing these names to our attention, and then we go to work from there.
Nice. Is there any you could share from the latest 2 to 100 for the group? Any that, or one that stood out to you?
Yeah. I mean, hard not to look at the Palantir.
Yeah.
PLTR breaking out of this base. It is, you know, because it's, it was a new IPO, PLTR, the market capitalization is 18 billion. So really right in that sweet spot. So we're looking for, you know, our particular 2 to 100 scan, looks at companies between 2 and 30 billion.
Yeah.
That's what we publish. So, you know, just cause there are 50 or 70 billion doesn't mean we don't think it goes higher. It's just our particular scan is looking for them earlier. So 2 to 30 is that sweet spot. This one right there at 18 billion, you know, makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, this thing could be, you know, this thing could be a $50 stock.
Yeah.
You know, and that puts it at 100 billion. You know, that's the 2 to 100, baby. That's what you're watching.
And finally, there's one more, the Young Aristocrats. That's quite an interesting one as well.
Yeah, this was inspired by one of our analysts' father, who's an accountant and just, you know, been investing forever and loves his dividend stocks. And so it's kind of inspired by him. And then we put our own spin on it with our momentum and relative strength and stuff. And so what we're looking for, so aristocrats are stocks that have raised their dividends every year for 25 consecutive years. at least 25. So like Johnson & Johnson and Coca-Cola have raised their dividends for like almost 60 years or something like that.
Yeah.
So those are aristocrats. So what we're looking for are the future aristocrats, or as we like to say, the young aristocrats. And so these are companies that have raised their dividends every year for between 5 and 9 consecutive years. And then, so in addition to increasing their dividends consistently, they need to go through a series of filters, relative strength and momentum filters that are our bread and butter.
Yeah.
And again, what does that do? It creates an interesting universe of stocks, names that perhaps we weren't looking at anyway, that allow us to then do our technical analysis and find opportunistic risk versus reward opportunities. And as we like to say, get paid to make money.
Yeah, that's good. It's the first time I've seen anything like that. It was pretty interesting when I saw that. So nice work. And Straza, who is, I believe, works for you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Steve Straza.
Yeah, Steve Straza mentioned...
His father was the inspiration.
He mentioned something on Twitter recently regarding the election. Election years tend to end on a high note, I think. That was what he was implying from previous elections. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. And, you know, after the election, the market tends to do well. You know, the smart people that I talked to were saying the same thing, kind of like, you know, the market's just waiting for it to be over, regardless of who wins, was the, you know, what my smart friends were saying. You know, I don't know the first thing about that stuff, so I'm just relaying what they told me. And I guess they were right. So I should probably keep them as friends. But just in general, election or no election, you know, the market tends to do well in the fourth quarter. In fact, the best 3-month period of the year is November through January. You know, that is historically, seasonally, the best 3-month period of the year. And the worst 6-month period is from May through October. As they say, sell in May and go away. But you have to remember to buy in November. Or as they say, buy in October and get yourself sober. You know, there's all sorts of silly sayings, but the reason people say those things is because those are the seasonal trends. So the worst 6-month period of the year between May and October, the stocks did great. Like, I don't have the stats off the top of my head. I think the NASDAQ was up like 40% or something stupid. Like, just like the market did very well in what is historically the worst time of the year when stocks are supposed to fall.
Yeah.
And they actually did really well. So to me, that's just evidence of buoyancy and strength in the market. And that carries over into, think about it. If stocks did so well during the worst 6 months, how do you think they're going to do when they're actually supposed to do well?
Yeah, that's true. I just wanted to finish with 4 quick questions, the quick fire round, if that's all right.
All right, let's go.
First one was, what's your edge? If you can narrow it down to one thing.
What is my edge? I think it's probably a combination of data and risk management. So data, in order to generate the ideas and organizing it, we've come such a long way as a firm and just myself over the past couple of decades to, you know, we could pretty much build anything we want, whenever we want, on the fly. You know, I haven't been at the point of having the technology in order to do that until the last few years. And we've really seen the science really help out the art that we do. But I think it's a lot of lessons that I've learned the hard way that keeps me disciplined in terms of risk management and understanding to check my ego at the door, understanding that I don't know what's going to happen next. It's very easy to say that. But in order to put that into practice and be disciplined enough to know, and so everybody's like, JC, how high do you think it's going to go? I'm not worried about how high it can go. I'm sure it can go very high. I want to know what is going to prove me wrong. I'm more interested in that. So I think my edge is being more self-aware than most investors care to be or even know that they should be.
Cool. Favorite book was the next one.
My favorite book. Well, I mean, listen, we're talking about charts, technical analysis, so let's stay on brand and, you know, go with, how do I not say Edwards and McGee, maybe Jack Schwager's Market Wizards, the first one, Edwards and McGee, classic, gotta read it, Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, gotta read it, John Murphy, Technical Analysis of Financial Markets, gotta read it, Brian Shannon, Technical Analysis of Using Multiple Time Frames, gotta read it. Martin Pring, Investor Psychology Explained, easy read, pretty cool book. Shoe Dog,
The Knight.
Phil Knight's book. Yeah. That was cool. Thought that was a really, really, really interesting book to read. And then I got some stuff I'm going to be dropping soon.
A new lesson that this year's taught you? You learned something new this year?
I think it just really reiterated the importance of relative strength. You know, I wouldn't say it's a new lesson, but I would definitely argue that I respect relative strength analysis more so than ever. Because, you know, so like on March the 10th, right? So the market bottomed on March the 12th, right? The S&P and the indexes and stuff like that, I think ended up bottoming like in March 26th or something like that. I forget. But later on that month. But the internals of the market, in other words, the most amount of lows, the most amount of stocks making new lows, most amount of sectors was on March the 12th. On March the 10th, 2 days earlier, we didn't know that the market was going to bottom 2 days later. But on March the 10th, we dropped what we called the coronavirus index, which were the stocks showing the highest momentum readings and relative strength in that environment that stocks were getting crushed. And at this point, like we were very successful at that point because we started getting bearish at the end of January, early February, buying bonds at the end of January, shorting stocks very aggressively. And that was, you know, obviously that paid off really, really well. So, you know, coming into, you know, early March, it's like, wow, like our downside targets have been hit. Like, you know, where do we start buying? Where do we start buying? And then before we're like, okay, where do we start buying? Why don't we focus on what we're going to buy, right? Let's focus less on the when and more on the what. So let's build a scan showing the most relative strength, showing most positive momentum. And the names that showed up on that list, Zoom, Activision, DocuSign, the relative strength was there. And we didn't know the market was going to bottom 2 days later, but we were already buying those stocks. And, you know, the rest, as they say, is history. But it was the relative strength. And, I mean, it was there. It was there. Go back and look at those names, how well they've done. Go back and see when they were breaking out already. Go back and see the ratio charts of those stocks relative to the rest of the market breaking out to all-time highs as the stock market's crashing. It was wisdom there.
And finally, a top prediction for next year, if you sort of have one in your mind. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. But do you have something?
Top prediction for 2021?
Yeah, next year.
Stocks will fluctuate.
Stocks will fluctuate. Okay. Thanks very much, JC. It's been awesome to have you on the show again. Lots of amazing insight, and I'm sure it's going to be really valuable to everyone on the that listens to the show. So thanks again for your time.
No, thank you. And not to cop out on your question about the prediction, but when J. Pierpont Morgan was asked the same question 120 years ago, that was his answer, and he was right.
Okay.
Shout out, Pierpont Morgan.
Well, cheers, Jesse.
All right.
See ya.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Just a quick note before we sign off. If you're looking for an easily digestible daily update on the markets, this might be of interest. Opto Updates is our short newsletter sent every day during the trading week, giving you a bulleted list of the top 7 stories from the global stock markets. We've done the hard work for you, highlighting relevant opportunities and trends. And in addition, we'll also keep you notified of any new products, stock reports, or webinars from the Opto world. If you're interested, sign up using the link in the show notes. And thanks also to CoFruition for consulting on and producing the show. Until next time.